Hi, my name is Ted Burns, and I'm Senior Director of Political Affairs and RADPAC for the American College of Radiology. And I want to welcome you to our inaugural episode of our new RADvocacy podcast hosted by RADPAC. And our goal with the podcast is to give behind-the-scenes look into the various advocacy efforts of the college. This is our first podcast, so we don't have introductory music or anything like that yet. We're not that fancy, but once we go viral, hopefully we'll go ahead and add that into our future podcast. But I'm honored today to have as our very first guest, very fittingly, Dr. Jacqueline Bellow, current RADPAC chair and incoming chair of the Board of Chancellors for the ACR. So first off, Dr. Bellow, welcome to the podcast, our first one. Hopefully we have many, many more to come in the future. And if you want to introduce yourself to our listeners, obviously many, many, many folks in the college know your name and your level of involvement, but if you just want to tell us kind of your start into radiology and then also your entrance into volunteer leadership positions with the college and where that's led you to today.
Well, first of all, I'm thrilled to launch the inaugural podcast for RADvocacy. Love the name and love the effort behind it. My journey into radiology is really based on anatomy. I loved anatomy in medical school, and I'm old enough. Those of you who have seen me, my gray hairs are not highlights. They are well-earned. I'm old enough that really cross-sectional imaging was just coming into the scene during my residency, and MRI really not until my fellowship in neuro. So to see the anatomy become unveiled when during my early residency, everything was on plain films, was really just amazing. So from loving the anatomy and seeing it in cross-section, again, these were early times. I loved every rotation, and I was going to be a general radiologist. But I realized that neuro was so complex that I would need to do some more neuro first. So I did a fellowship in neuro, after which I never looked back. Loved the anatomy, loved the clinical correlation. And yes, in those days, there was clinical correlation. The physical exam in those days was not done by scanning. You had a clinical picture, and then you correlated it with the imaging. And so there I was, loving anatomy, loving neuro. I went into neuroradiology.
Now, Dr. Bellow, before you get into your activities with the college, where did you go to med school, residency, and fellowship? Because I always find that interesting.
Okay. It's all one word, Ted. Columbia.
Okay.
Good. So I went to Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons, now known as the Vagelos College of Physicians and Surgeons. I stayed for residency, and then I stayed at Columbia's Neurological Institute for my fellowship training. And as I love to tell my resident applicants and my fellowship applicants who are interviewing at Montefiore, where I now work, gee, why did you ever leave Columbia? And I tell them to start my very own fellowship training program, but trust me, I was not run out of town. I've served on gold medal committees at Columbia and am a gold medalist, by the way. But I wear something blue every day for Columbia. And then I tell them, if you're not looking at it, you can use your imagination. So, Ted, that's the long answer. The short answer is Columbia.
Okay, good. And you are New York through and through. I mean, no one doubts that.
Well, now there's another story.
Okay.
I left New York after high school to attend college in New Hampshire, attending Dartmouth College, fasten your seatbelt.
Okay.
In its first year of co-education.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
And it was.
And you went up there and you studied, and then you said, I miss New York. I want to come back.
Well, at the time, Dartmouth still was only a two-year medical school, and I was well aware of the reputation of Columbia and wanted to be there for medical school. My dad is a grad of that school.
Okay.
And I stayed forever. Residency, fellowship, and 5 years as faculty.
Well, I think that's pretty cool. There's something great to be said for that. And you're not alone. There's obviously many of your colleagues who have done something similar. I know Dr. Mary Scanlon is the same way up there in the Philadelphia area at UPenn. And so when you hear those examples, I think it's really cool to have that continuity and connectedness to the community and to the school. It's pretty neat stuff. So then talk about, you go through your training, you get into practice, and then how did you start getting involved with the college, the American College of Radiology, from a volunteer perspective? And then obviously you've gone down pretty much a lot of the roads that you can go down because you're just a great volunteer leader. But how did you get involved, and then how did you start making decisions on, oh, I kind of want to pursue this, I want to pursue that? Kind of walk us through that journey.
Sure. Before I do, though, I'm going to finish the Columbia story.
Oh, sure.
When I interviewed at Columbia, I was interviewed. Now, mind you, I had been to Dartmouth in the first year of co-education. I was interviewed by a male physician, a urologist, and he said to me, "Tell me, Miss Bellow, why should Columbia be interested in you?" And I said, well, there are two reasons. Purposely not bringing up the fact that my father was an alum.
Okay.
I said, first of all, I was born here, which I was. I said, and secondly, I'm the only one out of seven children who was delivered by a medical student. So
oh, wow.
I know you do a good job.
And you've turned out pretty good, right? So, hey.
I think so. And I tell every time I'm addressing medical students, I say, please promise me one thing. When you're on OB, you'll really pay attention, because I was delivered by one of you. I was the second child, so I came out, so to speak, 8 minutes after Mom got to the hospital. Needless
wow.
to say, her private attending hadn't gotten there yet.
Wow. That's a pretty cool story. That's a very cool story. So go ahead. Going to the college, talk about that. Talk about your leadership
sure.
journeys.
Well, it became a leadership journey after being a membership journey. And I was so impressed, having attended, this wasn't by design, or I wasn't tuned in to what was really going on, but I attended the very last ACR meeting to be held elsewhere other than Washington, D.C.
So that's when they used to rotate it, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And it
and
wasn't.
I was so impressed
yeah.
that this organization would have me attend just as a member. I could attend. And so I did. And I really saw, obviously, what we're known for, a part of medicine that I think schools are doing better at today and residency programs are doing better at today. And I know that the AMA refers to it as health system science.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw a part of medicine that is important. And it's important not only for medicine, but it's important for our patients. And I became addicted. I wanted to make a difference. And at the same time, my husband-to-be was becoming increasingly more involved at the AMA. So he's a neurosurgeon. And as a neuroradiologist, I've always loved the fact that we tell neurosurgeons where to go and we tell them what to do when they get there.
But that's not like at home, right?
No. But Ted, just remember, don't bite the hand that feeds you.
I know.
Left alone, it would be cold cereal and tuna out of the can for my husband. But seriously, he was making inroads at the AMA, which was the powerhouse for economics and advocacy for the bigger house of medicine. And I saw this same opportunity playing out for my very own profession, radiology. Not that we weren't also part of the bigger picture, but this was radiology centric for the issues that not only affect us, but again, our patients and how they get to us.
You know, it's interesting too, because you kind of hear the discussion internally that folks have, within themselves, and then kind of externally with their colleagues. You know, we want to get involved with the AMA. We want to get involved with our specialty society. We want to get involved with our subspecialty societies. Obviously, you're very involved with that as well. And you know, you only have so much time in your day. There's only so much bandwidth. And it's always curious to me how people kind of make that identification of one versus another, or two of three. You know, to do everything is really almost impossible because of your clinical schedule and life, by the way, too. You know, we tend to forget in our DC office that all of our volunteer leaders have families and they've got interests outside of work and outside of, you know, volunteering. And so I always wonder how people arrive to that decision, because it's a tough decision, right? You want to, AMA is kind of like the established thing, and presence within the AMA is critically important from the representation perspective. And then also, you know, your own specialty society, you obviously feel a little bit more connected to that. And then, you know, obviously even more so with the subspecialty. So how, when you're doing that, you're watching your fiance, husband, going into the AMA track. And how did you decide, you know, I wanted, because you're involved with AMA as well, I believe. So kind of how do you pick and choose? And is it a timing thing? Is it kind of where you are in your career at a particular time? How does that all work? Or how did that work for you?
Sure. So it worked for me in a very natural way. To begin with, I waited until he was completely done with his positions at the AMA before I actually ran for a council at the AMA. I would attend the meetings. I would, you know, again, be an easy sell on how interesting the policy discussions were. Uh-huh. But I, again, just like my Columbia interview, was not there to ride on someone else's coattails. So after he served as chair of a council, and then 8 years on the board, and then as AMA president, and then immediate past president, the second he was done, I started my engine and ran for the Council on Medical Education. And again, that's something that came very natural to me, because the reason I had left Columbia to go to Montefiore was to start my very own fellowship training program. And so that was a natural segue. And at the same time, I was representing my specialty society, the ASNR, as a member of the House of Delegates. So that was a no-brainer, Ted, mm-hmm. because I could kill two birds with one stone with one meeting.
Very efficient.
Now, when you come to the work-life discussion and you hear me purposely and purposefully avoid the word balance, because there is no such thing, I prefer to think of it as work and life synergy. Okay. There are times in my life where for a week at a time, it's going to be all work. all work. This is coming up. This deadline's coming up. This meeting's coming up. I'm responsible for chairing this, whatever, big presentation in a symposium. It's going to be work. And for another week at a time, maybe, it's going to be life and family. Whether it is, again, one of seven children, one of my sibs, my husband, my parents, who I'm still blessed to have at the age of 96. Then attention turns to life. Now, when it comes to kids, I cheated. And I always come clean with medical students when they say, how did you manage? I know you've got three sons. I know you have seven grandchildren. How did you ever manage? And the answer always is, I'll come clean. I cheated. My husband had my children for me. When I married my husband, I inherited his three sons. So I don't pretend it's easy for women who have their own. That said, having lived through their having the grandchildren, which in many ways was closer to the age range of what my colleagues were living themselves, it became, again, synergy. I would go to a meeting a day late because one of the daughters-in-law, the one with three kids, needed help while her husband, also a physician, she's a physician, he's a physician, was out of town at a national meeting, and it was the nanny's day off. So why wouldn't I fill in for the nanny, right?
Yeah.
And it's just a question of prioritizing. And you just have to know when that limit is there, you have to know when to say no.
Yeah, it's a hard word to say.
It's hard. And that fork in my road presented itself to me not long ago. I told you how I got involved at ACR.
Right.
I ran for the nominating committee. I ran, not appointed, for council steering committee. And then I was tapped to chair the Commission on Quality and Safety. And you talk about something that is about as close to education as it can be, because you don't only want to teach radiologists what it is they need to know. You want to teach them the quality aspects. And because it's a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it is radiation, you want to teach them the safety aspects. And a lot of it is procedural. And you want to teach them the quality and the safety aspects when it comes to procedures. So that was another natural extension for me. And I served as chair of that commission before I was then tapped for vice chair of the Board of Chancellors. But I'm going back to the fork in the road. Okay. Because I was sitting there as commission chair when someone put a bug in my ear about running for the AMA board. And needless to say, having been an attendee at those meetings, having served on a council, and then having chaired that council at the AMA, I knew a lot of people. In fact, some of the radiologists currently running for positions at the AMA have asked me for my advice and my contacts and my help in how to run that campaign, how to get to know people, how to get people to trust you. So someone asked, do you think you'll run for the board? And I did not run immediately after serving on council. And I had a lot of people at the AMA say, why aren't you running for the board? And I said, I haven't ruled it out. And at the same time, ACR leadership said to me, are you interested in ACR leadership? And it was a tough decision to make because one is perhaps having a bigger impact in the world of medicine, capital M, and the other was perhaps a little more challenging to impact that bigger M word, because you're within a specialty society, but one that mirrors the governance structure of the AMA and one that is looked to with great respect by the AMA and their lobbying efforts because of the impact that we can have. And I think for a long time, Ted, kudos to you, to your team, and to others, we had a bigger impact on the Hill than we had in that House of Delegates at the AMA.
Yeah.
And it used to pain me to hear different people say, well, we go to the AMA meeting, but we're sort of the skunk at the picnic.
Right.
And I said, that's got to stop. Nope. We are going to be the prime entity at the picnic. And perhaps the best way to have that effect is by working through my own specialty rather than running for that board at the AMA. That's a decision I made. I've never looked back.
Well, so let's talk a little bit more about that in the sense of you were previously on our RADPAC board and then your terms expired. And now as part of the process currently with the RADPAC board chair, in your capacity as vice chair, incoming chair of the BOC, you kind of automatically become the chair of RADPAC. So, you know, being you weren't a newbie as RADPAC chair, you had kind of been through the RADPAC process before, but obviously being the chair takes on a whole different sense of responsibility, different sense of visibility, different sense of expectations of accessibility. And so, you know, what's, as chair of RADPAC, what's kind of been the biggest surprise during your tenure so far? And maybe what's been the biggest challenge that you've faced so far?
Sure. Well, I'm going to go back to having been just a regular RADPAC board member. Mm-hmm. And Ted, that came to me naturally because, not to brag, but I was captain of my high school cheerleading team. And so I love rallying the troops, okay? And I, unlike plenty of people, it's not good, it's not bad, it's just different. I have no problem asking people for money.
I was going to fill in that sentence. I knew exactly that you were going to say you have no problem asking for money, because I know you have no problem asking for money, which makes you such a great board member, and you're a rarity. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
But no, it's because of how that sentence is finished. As long as it's not for me.
Okay.
Okay. It is easy for me, for foundations, for RADPAC, for other causes. It is easy for me to leverage the credibility that I've worked hard at to try to use the trust that hopefully people have in me and my reasoning to convince them of a need. And my point has always been to just be a player. You don't have to be a six-figure donor. But, you know, in fundraising, I'm sure you know this, Ted, there's a saying that every mile is made up of inches. Lots of times, those big donors start out as little donors.
100%.
Whether it's for a political cause or a charitable cause. Okay. And the two are not to be confounded.
Right. I'll give you really quickly an example. We had during our annual meeting, I tell the story a lot when I do presentations to chapters and different conferences. Probably about 7-8 years ago, a resident came up to me at the RADPAC board, or excuse me, RADPAC booth during the annual meeting and said, hey, you know, I'm kind of really interested in RADPAC and it seems like there's a lot of value and ROI, but I'm a resident. Can I take a form? Talk to my wife tonight, and then I'll come back to the booth tomorrow and make a contribution. I said, absolutely, no problem. So the resident comes back the next day, tracks me down. I'm like, oh, hey, how you doing? You know, thanks for coming back. because you never know if they're really going to come back or not. So the resident came back and he was like, you know, I'm kind of embarrassed. Like, I can only do $20. It's like, I don't make a ton. I got tons of debt. You know, my wife wasn't super pumped about me doing a lot of money to Rad Pack. And I said, your $20 is more than about 85% of the people who are your peers who don't contribute at all. So I will take your $20 happily. I think it's a fantastic investment on your future and all the things that we're doing to help preserve your future. And I said, you know, I hope that we can get your confidence and trust and support as we move forward. That person now gives $500 a year. And so it's really cool to think back to that moment in time. And I didn't know that they would continue to keep giving and continue to be a generous supporter at that. But it just really goes to emphasize your point that, you know, I think some of the hesitation a lot of people have with giving is this perception that if you don't give an X amount or you don't give enough, it's not impactful, but it is. And so it's an interesting kind of perception game that we're trying to fight and change. But anyway, I wanted to add that story in because it's I always think of that story. I always think of that person and just it made a real impact on me that they were willing to kind of step forward and make that sacrifice and have the trust in us. So it's pretty cool.
Absolutely.
So going back to the surprise and challenge, now that you're on the board, chair, kind of you knew what you were getting into, but anything that kind of you didn't realize you were getting into.
Yes. For one thing, something that no one realized we were getting into. The worst five-letter, four-letter word that everyone has known for the past 2 years, COVID.
Yeah.
And what a showstopper that became. And it was just not the time to, I mean, people were trying to stay alive.
Yeah.
Quite literally. And so, right, that no one expected that. And so that was certainly a surprise. Let's say COVID hadn't happened. Was there still an additional surprise? And the answer is yes. It was a lot different from my last time on the board because of, first of all, the additional responsibilities, directions I was being pulled as vice chair of the Board of Chancellors, and the climate we were in, Ted, never, with or without COVID, while the virus was multiplying, we were busy dividing and dividing and then dividing again as a country. And sadly, in many over many different issues, dividing as an organization. And you know better than anyone that if you don't go in strong and you don't go in with one voice, you might as well not go in.
Yeah.
And so that was an unwelcome surprise, just as unwelcome as the five-letter, four-letter word COVID was. But you know what? That should be. I'm not saying it is. And in many ways it isn't, but it should be an easier fight to fight because I've long believed, and I think you've heard me make the not so funny joke before, that I've earned the name Pollyanna for myself.
Right.
But I have long believed that there is a way to find common ground while holding your own ground. There is a way. And for whatever degree of overlap between two opposing Venn diagrams, or find the intersection and just move forward in that space and at least get something done.
Now, you know, you know I'm a big baseball guy. And, you know, we talk about it all the time. Now it's funny how it's gone in this evolution as our kids have kind of gotten through different ages and playing. But, you know, it used to be when they started out, just get singles and doubles. Don't try to hit a home run. You're not big enough to hit a home run. Then as they get older and they're still on the smaller field, they're actually hitting home runs. But then they keep trying to hit home runs, they strike out. And I said, if you would just get a single, people are going to score. You don't need to hit a home run, even though I know you can now with a smaller field and you being bigger. And now they've just gone to the big field, so no one's hitting home runs again. You're almost from the very beginning where you were when you're a little kid at playing t-ball. And again, hit singles, hit doubles. Just be productive. Move the ball forward. Move your teammates forward on the bases, and you'll get them home. You don't have to do it all in one big swing. And I think that gets lost. And that can be said for so many different things in life. It can be said for so many things in fundraising, and particularly on Capitol Hill, with, you know, legislative negotiations we're constantly involved in up there, trying to say, hey, look, we know we're not going to get our whole laundry list of things accomplished probably, but man, if you can just give us these two priorities up there, we would really, you know, be able to move the ball forward in the next negotiating round. So it's a great point, because it's so reflective of so many different things in life, but everyone wants the big score. That's the big sexy thing to do, is, you know, go big or go home. But man, I'm a big believer in just keep pushing forward, and eventually you'll get what you need to get. But I think that's kind of lost in our society now, but that's just my random
Tangent. It's not so random, and it's echoing what you said earlier about the $20 contribution.
Well, that's true. Yeah, no, that's true. No, that's true.
You know, it's just a rewind of that, really. And I'm glad to revisit that story for a moment, because while I know it wasn't your intention, if after this podcast you share with me the identity of that person, I'm going to make it my personal challenge to get them up to, you know, a number. Maybe suggesting a match would even do that. Why
yeah,
not?
We'll have to do that offline, but yeah.
Right, absolutely. But no, you also mentioned your whole laundry list, and that that's echoing something that I brought up just minutes ago. Yeah, while you're mentioning your laundry list, you don't need to bring up dirty laundry. Yeah. And you don't need to hold grudges. And that was another surprise, Ted, that came to me as Rad Pack chair this year. After a incident on Capitol Hill now over a year ago.
Yeah.
People held Rad Pack personally responsible for contributions that Rad Pack had made in the prior calendar year. Mm-hmm. Now, Ted, you're a baseball fan. I trust you know many of Yogi Berra's favorite sayings.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. Do you think we knew making certain contributions that I'll don't need to remind you, but I'll remind our listeners that we make to people because of the committees they sit on, or maybe even chair in Congress, the committees where our action takes place? How frustrating is it to be held responsible for something that those people were going to do? I mean, anyone who has that crystal ball, I'll take it. Because when I do become chair of the board, I'm going to need all the help I can get just to keep ACR whole.
Yeah, you know, it's a tricky deal, because our job, and we take it very seriously, this part of it, is really doing our due diligence, doing our research, getting as much information as we can on a member of Congress or a candidate, whatever the case may be. And we're not going to know 100% of their background or 100% of their true ideology or how they would respond in a moment of crisis. And you kind of have a good judge, or you try to have a good judge on people as people, right? And we don't give to anyone that we've never met with in person. We take that very seriously. I mean, a lot of PACs will say, you know, just fill out this campaign survey, and if you say all the right things on the survey, then we're going to give you money. And I've never done that. We've never done a survey. But I said, I can't recommend that we support your campaign unless we meet with you in person. I want to see your body language. I want to see your nonverbal communication. I want to, if I ask you a tough question, I want to kind of see, do you squirm or not, and all those types of things. And it's interesting, because people that we probably would have guessed would react one way surprised us, and people we thought would act another way as a result of that attack on January 6th acted the other way. And, you know, you thought you kind of knew people pretty well. And it's not really until you go through those types of levels of crisis that's pretty highly visible and pretty intense, you really don't get to fully be able to judge someone, right? And so then we're like, wow, we had no idea. And there's no way anyone would have any idea that so-and-so would react such and such. And it was very telling. It was disappointing. It was very bothersome. And it was very personal to us because we take a lot of pride in that. But yeah, I mean, and then of course people look at it and, you know, regardless of, you know, I guess whether what side of the aisle you are and how you perceive everything that happened that day and since, you know, you're going to come at it pretty strong that way. And it's just really difficult. And even to this day, we still field questions about it. I feel like people have gotten a better understanding of our process. I feel like we try to really hyper communicate our reasoning behind, you know, some of the things we did and the members that we supported and some of the controversial members. And, you know, you're not going to be able to get that message out to everyone. But I think people realize that at our core, we were trying to do what was best for radiology, that there's no personal bias, there's no personal agenda by any of our staff or by our organization. We are looking at it strictly from a, you know, kind of black and white radiology lens. And as we get further and further away from it, you know, it's easier to move forward and to move on a little bit. But man, that was a challenge that neither you nor I could predict. And that was some pretty rough. We had a lot of rough conversations but with each other and with our board. And I think they were productive and helpful. And I think we all learned a lot about each other and learned about kind of what our true mission is. And so in a way it was, you know, some blessings in disguise, but man, that was a pretty rough couple weeks there.
Right. But Ted, to use your own words, in order to move forward, okay, Ted, you're driving the car. To move forward, do you look through the windshield or do you look in the rear view mirror?
Yeah.
With the rear view mirror.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I just want to say there's another feeling that comes over you when you are chairing the RADPAC board. And that is something that you and I have discussed, but I think it's important to get out there, you know, and communicate to members the ideas that we've had in making that position something much more consistent and much more, you know, I sang a song earlier about credibility. You know, when there's a revolving door of people changing every couple of years, you know, these people in Congress don't keep score sheets like you all do in baseball. You know, they don't know who's who or what's what. And so I think for that reason and for focus and alliance with our GR people, I really think that our idea to dissociate the two, and I'm not doing this because I don't personally want to do it anymore. In fact, I've put my mouth where my sentiments are and say, I'll be the bridge until we find the right person.
Yeah.
And when it comes to finding right people, I'm in favor of people applying to the RADPAC board.
I'm super in favor of this, as you know, and I'm excited about what this could mean for us moving forward. I want to be respectful of your time. So I want to just skip to kind of some lightning round questions that I'm going to do with you, if that's okay. And then we'll close this out. So I think hopefully people can tell that you and I over the years have established a pretty good rapport and relationship. And I do want to, I'd be remiss if I didn't say how much I appreciate you and all that you've done and just, you know, your accessibility and your interest level and investment with everything. But just for fun, a little lightning round to close this out. I want to know your favorite food, your favorite place to travel, your favorite hobby, and your favorite quote. And just like boom, 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 boom. So favorite food, go. What's your favorite food?
You're going to laugh. Growing up, we were allowed to choose our very own birthday supper every year. Okay. Hamburgers.
Wow. Yeah. Never would have guessed.
No, but my brother's lobster, the other brother's steak, hamburger. Okay. But a good one.
I'll have to write that down. Favorite place to travel?
Italy, hands down. Okay. I have a sister who lives there. I'm not supposed to have favorites, but she might be my favorite sister. Love the country, love the people, speak the language. Allora, la prossima domanda, per favore. That means the next question, please.
Hobby, activity, favorite thing to do outside of all that you do?
Love to play tennis, love to play golf. Not great at golf. When my husband tries to tell me what I'm doing wrong, which he's also doing probably, I say, sweetie, I'm here for the suntan. But I love it.
Now, are you for tennis? Are you tennis or are you transitioning to pickleball?
No, I don't. I can't do another thing. Tennis. Okay. Real tennis.
Favorite saying or quote?
So my high school yearbook quote, I think, tells a lot about who I am.
Okay.
And that was, youth is not a time in life. It is a state of mind.
I think that's a great quote. I love it. Well, Dr. Bello, I want to thank you for taking the time. Your schedule's so busy. I appreciate and value you very much. And hopefully our listeners enjoy this inaugural podcast for Radvocacy, hosted by RadPAC. And hopefully we'll get you on maybe for like our 50th episode or our 100th episode when we have a big one to celebrate. We'll get you back on.
Well, hope to still be here, Ted. Hope to still be here. And let's hit some home runs, huh?
Yeah.
March chapter challenge starts. Yeah.
March chapter challenge and the gala too. Let's not forget the gala. But thank you very much, Dr. Bello.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And have a great day.
Thanks to our listeners. Bye-bye. Yep.
Take care.
Ciao.